You must believe a kiss is just a kiss, a sigh of forever.
Welcome to another episode of You Must Remember This, the podcast dedicated to exploring the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century, part of the Panoply Network. I'm your host, Karina Longworth. And this is another installment in our ongoing series, 6 Degrees of Joan Crawford.
Actually, I think I was just born dancing, and that's all I ever wanted to do in life.
I know what you like.
Now, why can't you be friendly?
But I am being friendly.
No, I mean it. Friendship's much more lasting than love.
It's called,
What's keeping you awake?
Dreams. Bad dreams.
I don't see how any home can be complete without children.
Born dancing.
I'm sorry this had to happen. Oh, you're going to listen.
In our last episode, we discussed The Women, a George Cukor film starring Norma Shearer, Joan Crawford, Rosalind Russell, and dozens of other actresses, and no actors. The Women was a massive hit in 1939, the second highest grossing film of that year, after Gone with the Wind. But The Women was a high point in what was otherwise a difficult period for Joan Crawford, ranging from the late 1930s, when she was named box office poison, and extending through the mid-1940s. Crawford would later call that period her middle years. It was a time when she was forced to become acutely aware of her age and the fact that Hollywood, which was still less than 25 years old, was already in the habit of cycling out actresses once their sell-by date had passed, and cycling in new ingenues. A decade and a half earlier, Joan had been one of those ingenues. Now, she was watching teenagers like Judy Garland and Lana Turner surpass her at her own beloved home studio. They might just as well have sent all of the women of a certain age to Alaska and pensioned us off, Crawford later said. If the 20th century was the American century, it was also the Hollywood century. And born in 1904, Joan Crawford aged with her country and with her culture. As the United States as a whole was propelled into redefining what it meant to be an American after World War II, Joan Crawford, during this time, found herself at a new studio, in a new phase of life, and in need of a transformed identity on screen. So today, we're going to talk about Joan Crawford's middle career, a time when she remakes herself from aging, slumping MGM dead weight, into a middle-aged powerhouse who starred in some of the most interesting films about adult womanhood of the 1940s and 1950s. During the decade-long stretch that began with her jump from MGM to Warner Brothers, Joan Crawford would star in several of her best films, and some of her worst films, while also aging through treacherous years for an actress whose 20-year career had been built in large part on her glamour and sex appeal. Where actresses of a previous generation, such as, say, Mary Pickford, had tried to combat aging by showing that they still had it in terms of sexual appeal, the movies Joan Crawford made while she was in her 40s, largely movies she chose under her new deal at Warner Brothers, confronted the social and emotional problems faced by an aging woman head on. These were movies in which she was sexually and romantically rejected, in which more often than not her characters were women who had learned a kind of self-sufficiency, who had learned or would learn that they didn't need a man for financial support. And that made it all the harder to negotiate the pitfalls of adult romance. Previous episodes in this series have related Joan Crawford's experiences to those of men in her life. Future episodes will do the same for women in Crawford's life. This episode sort of does both and neither. During the period under discussion here, which is basically the early 1940s through the mid-1950s, Joan Crawford's romantic life wasn't that exciting. The men in her life worth talking about are the directors she worked with, notably men who would later be embraced, first by the French and then by some American academics and critics, as auteurs, meaning artists who managed to put a personal stamp on their films while working within the confines of the studio system. And there's one major, albeit fictional, woman at the center of this chapter of the story, Mildred Pierce. Join us, won't you, for the fourth installment of our series, 6 Degrees of Joan Crawford.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
And I want to tell you about a podcast I think you're going to love.
Who Weekly is a podcast about everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't.
Does celebrity news stress you out?
Are there too many people you've literally never heard of?
Check out Who Weekly, a podcast hosted by Lindsay Weber and me, Bobby Finger.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest Who celebrity stories of the moment, and if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we'll answer the most burning listener queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly on the Odyssey app or wherever else you get your podcasts.
In the waning years of her MGM contract, also the waning years of her 30s, Crawford jumped headlong into domesticity. With second husband Franco Tone gone and several miscarriages and abortions behind her, she refused to miss out on what the society she lived in deemed to be the quintessential experience of an adult woman's life: motherhood. Always the trailblazer, the 37-year-old double divorcee decided to adopt. California wouldn't let single mothers legally take custody of children, so after obtaining a little blonde baby from a quote-unquote baby broker, Joan drove the child to Las Vegas to make it legal there. Joan initially named her first daughter Joan Crawford Jr., but she renamed the blonde baby Christina for her first birthday. Why the change? Joan recalled the trouble her first husband had had being a junior. "I decided there might be confusion with our having the same name. What if she wanted to be an actress?" Joan had big ambitions for motherhood. "I hoped that I would not only be her mother, but that as she grew up, we would be best friends." And then came a new husband. Philip Terry had appeared briefly in Mannequin with Joan and Spencer Tracy. He and Joan started dating in the summer of 1942, and within 2 months, they were married. It seems like Joan was looking for a father to go with her new baby. But by this time, maybe she should have known better than to try to marry yet another actor whose career was far less active and promising than her own. Joan threw herself into the role of wife. She let all of her household help go and busied herself packing Philip lunches and making Philip dinner and fixing Philip a drink, or two or three or more drinks, to unwind after work. Joan, who quickly grew bored with keeping house, would join her third husband while he drank. And this is when she picked up the vodka habit, which she'd carry for the rest of her days. In the early days of her marriage to Terry, Joan made 2 World War II-themed films, Reunion in France and Above Suspicion. Neither was exactly a classic, and the latter, starring Joan and Fred McMurray as newlyweds on the run from Nazis on their honeymoon, stands today as a particularly campy example of Hollywood fighting the war with the materials it had at hand. After that, Joan went to Louis B. Mayer and told him that she wanted out. She was caught in the maw of the machine at a studio where she might get to do 1 good movie every year or two, but would definitely have to make between 2 and 5 not very good movies in the same span of time. Joan hadn't been in a great movie since The Women in 1939, and now it was 1943. She wanted to be somewhere where she would be appreciated. Joan almost definitely expected Louis B. Mayer to beg her to stay. And he didn't want to see her go, but he didn't beg. Louis B. Mayer probably would have loved to have Joan Crawford on his payroll forever, if it could have been 1932 forever. But times were changing. Mayer had new pet stars, and Joan was no longer enough of a box office draw to merit special protection. Instead of asking Crawford to stay, or graciously allowing her to walk away, Mayer and MGM told her freedom could be hers if she'd pay $50,000 for early voiding of her contract. There's been speculation that Joan was essentially being asked to buy the studio's silence on her porno past. But maybe it was sadder than that. Maybe Mayer was actually that petty. One thing is clear, Joan had always defended Mayer and seen him as a father figure. Now, like every other father figure she had ever known, he had sent her the message that she didn't matter to him as much as he mattered to her. She had to leave MGM to save face, but she was less sure than ever that she was making the right decision. As she later put it, "There was this person inside me, knowing she wanted to do good things, great things, and knew she could do them. But on the outside, there was this woman with a plastic face nobody really wanted to see." Joan signed with a new agent, the formidable Lou Wasserman, and Wasserman negotiated a deal for his client at Warner Brothers. It didn't look like the best deal at first. Joan's new salary would represent a significant pay cut compared to what she used to make at MGM. But in exchange for reduced income, Jack Warner had agreed to give Joan more power. She would have total say in which movies she made and didn't make. Joan Crawford would make a couple of real bombs in the early 1950s, and she ended her time at Warner Brothers with the film that she would later say she most regretted making, The Woman is Dangerous. But at first, she chose wisely. Her first movie at Warner Brothers was Hollywood Canteen, the wartime morale booster about the nightclub for servicemen, tirelessly run by Betty Davis, the reigning queen of the WB lot, and Joan's future rival. Joan had a short, dance-centric scene in the cavalcade of stars hodgepodge of a movie, and other than actually helping out at the real Hollywood Canteen, this was the only work Crawford did in the 2 full years between the last Joan Crawford vehicle at MGM and the first at Warner Brothers. This was shocking for an actress who, for most of her life in Hollywood, had never stopped working. By contrast, she had starred in 6 movies in the 2-year period between 1937 and 1939, beginning when her prospects at MGM were beginning to dim, and continuing through The Women. Part of the downtime had to do with Warner Brothers' difficulty in providing Joan Crawford with material that Joan Crawford felt was good enough for Joan Crawford. They were not a studio with a rich history of female superstars, and many of the scripts that Joan was offered had already been offered to and rejected by Betty Davis. Joan spent some of her first 2 years under contract to Warner Brothers, tagging along to work at RKO with her husband, where she'd hide out in Philip Terry's dressing room and help him run lines. Under her contract to Warner Brothers, Joan had the unusual privilege of being allowed to stay on salary while she rejected script after script. But the money didn't matter. She had never been in it for the money. She wanted to work. Who was she if she wasn't starring in a Joan Crawford movie? So when Jack Warner finally had enough and told her he would suspend her salary if she didn't agree to appear in a film called Never Forget, Joan told him that she understood and she agreed with him. This proved to Warner that Joan wasn't just some lazy older lady. that she cared enough about quality to fight for it. In fact, she cared so much that when a film she really wanted to make finally came around, Joan Crawford willingly made a screen test for it, something she never would have done or been asked to do at MGM. Mildred Pierce was based on the novel by James M. Cain, whose Double Indemnity had recently provided a juicy role for Joan's friend Barbara Stanwyck. Warner Brothers was gearing up to offer the part of Mildred to Stanwyck, too, until director Michael Curtiz saw Joan's test. This was Joan's dream movie. Curtiz had just directed the Oscar-winning Casablanca, and the plot would give her a chance to present herself to the world in the new role she had adopted off-screen, that of mother.
How could you do such a thing? How could you?
I got the money, didn't I?
Oh, I see.
I'll have to give Wally part of it to keep him quiet, but there's enough left for me.
Money. That's what you live for, isn't it? You'd do anything for money, wouldn't you? Even blackmail.
Oh, grow up.
I've never denied you anything. Anything money could buy, I've given you. But that wasn't enough, was it? All right, Vita, from now on, things are going to be different.
I'll say they're going to be different. Why do you think I went to all this trouble? Why do you think I want money so badly?
All right, why?
Are you sure you want to know?
Yes.
Then I'll tell you. With this money, I can get away from you.
Vita.
From you and your chickens and your pies and your kitchens and everything that smells of grease. I can get away from this shack with its cheap furniture and this town and its dollar days and its women that wear uniforms and its men that wear overalls.
Vita, I think I'm really seeing you for the first time in my life, and you're cheap and horrible.
You think just because you made a little money you can get a new hairdo and some expensive clothes and turn yourself into a lady. But you can't, because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing. With this money, I can get away from every rotten, stinking thing that makes me think of this place or you.
Mildred Pierce is about a married mother of two daughters who kicks her deadbeat husband to the curb when she suspects he's having an affair. Mildred goes to work as a waitress, but her daughter Veda has expensive tastes, and the mother will do anything to give her daughter what she desires. Mildred ends up starting her own business built around the pies she's long been baking out of her own kitchen. The business takes off, and soon, Mildred is running a restaurant empire. This gives Veda the material things she wants, but as a busy working mother, Mildred struggles to raise her daughters right. The younger one dies, and Veda becomes a spoiled terror, who ultimately has an affair with a young man who Mildred married in her unending quest to provide a better life for her ungrateful daughter, exchanging Mildred's new money for this leech's old money name. The film climaxes with Veda shooting this sleazeball, a murder that was not in the book on which the film was based. In the book, Mildred eventually realizes that she is born a rotten egg and lets Veda have the husband. In the film, Mildred's attempts to protect Veda continue to the end. Critic and historian Janine Bassinger, who was also friends with Joan Crawford, called Mildred Pierce a personification of, quote, the totally capable but truly furious American woman. The fury is important because it's not just Veda who believes that she deserves a better life, but Mildred too. Except that Mildred believes she deserves not cars and homes, but love. That the quest for both material satisfaction and emotional satisfaction is both endless and, for the American woman, impossible to achieve without terrible sacrifice and tragedy, underlies the film's quasi-happy ending, which reunites Mildred with Veda's father once the threat of the horrible daughter is contained. Mildred had to go to work to give her daughters what she thought they deserved, and in doing so, she deprived herself of the basic human love and compassion that Mildred deserved. There were not a lot of experiences had by everyday American women that Joan Crawford circa 1944 could relate to, but the seeming inability to have both satisfying love and satisfying work was one of them. In that sense, Mildred's professional success becomes a beacon for post-war female viewers who can't get out of their own kitchens, who are stuck baking pies for husbands who don't remunerate them financially, and may fall short in making them feel valued in other ways, too. In a career dedicated to the struggle between using one's womanly talents to benefit a man and using one's womanly talents to benefit oneself, Mildred Pierce was the pinnacle. Incredibly, Joan Crawford had never been nominated for an Oscar before Mildred Pierce. She didn't attend the ceremony that year, famously. Her excuse was that she was sick, which she may have been, likely from nerves, or she may have been seeking the upper hand in terms of publicity. If she had gone to the ceremony, she would have been just like most every other actress that had ever been nominated. And if she won, she would have had to either rehearse a variation on the reaction and acceptance of every previous winner, or somehow find a way to do it her own way. She did the latter by not showing up, but allowing visitors to come to her bedside as soon as her win was announced. Michael Curtiz hand-delivered the statuette to Joan at home, photographer in tow, to make sure the first in the history of the Academy Awards moment was duly captured. Joan had no false modesty about her achievement. She later said, "Whether Academy voters were giving it to me sentimentally for Mildred or for 200 years of effort, the hell with it. I deserved it." The bedside Oscar delivery was a turning point for Joan. She'd later say that she woke up the very next morning with the realization that her career, as she had known it, was over. "I had money problems, personal problems, career problems, and having a few drinks didn't solve any of them," she reflected later. "Then came Mildred Pierce and the award, and I could put at least some of the pieces together. But only some." She started responding to the New World Order by cleaning house. After the awards ceremony, Joan phoned Luella Parsons to give her an exclusive. She and Philip Terry were getting a divorce. As Joan later explained, the golden statuette fulfilled some version of the need that men had fulfilled previously. "I'd wanted an Oscar for a long time," she said. "I thought it would be wonderful to live with one. It is. Oscar is a wonderful man in my life, one who will never leave me. One day, I'll have to leave him." Despite her vision of Mildred Pierce as an ending, in some ways, that film revitalized Joan Crawford's career. Before Mildred Pierce, only the memory of past glories was keeping her a star. After Mildred Pierce, she was nominated for 2 additional Oscars, and more interestingly, was frequently used by great directors in interesting genre films as something somewhat more than a mere actress or movie star. The Joan Crawford of the late 1940s and early 1950s, in films directed by men like Jean Negulesco, Otto Preminger, Nicholas Ray, and journeyman studio guys who haven't yet been embraced by the auteurists, was both the epitome of Hollywood in all of its exaggeration and excess, and a self-contained critique. Her performances become almost Brechtian, signifying to the audience everything unnatural that went into the creation of a star, while at the same time allowing them to indulge in the pleasures of watching a pro perform stardom at beyond the highest level. Predating the Douglas Sirk masterworks, in some cases by almost a decade, these Joan Crawford movies are the beginning of what we can now identify as a subversive Hollywood within Hollywood. Some of the key films of this era are Humoresque, which I love, but which we've already talked about in our previous episode on John Garfield, Possessed, made in 1947 and with no connection to the Crawford Gable film of the 1930s by the same name, Daisy Kenyon, Sudden Fear, and Johnny Guitar. The most subtle and surprising of these is Daisy Kenyon, directed by Otto Preminger. You could read the logline of Daisy Kenyon and presume that it is a typical melodrama. Joan plays the title character, a commercial artist who has spent years in an affair with a slick lawyer, played by Dana Andrews, who is never going to leave his wife. Then she meets another guy, a war vet and boat designer, played by Henry Fonda, who asks her to marry him. She says yes, but the lawyer cad never really goes away, and Joan is eventually forced to choose between them. This is literally what happens in Daisy Kenyon, but the movie is so much more than the typical rendering of a Hollywood love triangle. And weirdly, so much less, too. Henry Fonda's World War II vet seems to be what we would today call on the spectrum. He says whatever he feels, blurting out at the beginning of his first date with Daisy that his wife is dead. By the end of the date, he tells Daisy he's in love with her. It initially seems like Daisy's choice is going to be of a fairly typical Hollywood romance variety, between the guy who is too emotional, too sincere, and the guy who is apparently incapable of genuine emotion or sincerity. Dana Andrews' philandering lawyer initially seems like the worst. He calls everybody baby and honey bun, and he expects Joan to be at his beck and call, and worse, he has some kind of weird power over her. She keeps trying to end things with him, and he somehow turns her every no into a yes. But then, in what is so peripheral to the story of the film as to barely qualify as a subplot, he breaks his tradition of taking lucrative political cases and instead agrees to help a Japanese-American man who fought with the U.S. in Italy fight in court to get land back that was seized from him during the internment sweeps. We're meant to understand that this pro bono case is the first selfless thing that this lawyer guy has ever done in his life. And when he loses, it changes him. We are also gradually made aware that the wife that he won't leave is not a pure victim of his philandering. In fact, she's physically abusive to their daughter and is probably unfit to parent alone. Meanwhile, though Daisy and Henry Fonda's character marry, their intimacy is hampered by his lingering grief over his dead wife and what seems like post-war PTSD. You start to realize that Daisy Kenyon is really a film about what it was like to be of the generation of women who were unmarried when World War II began, who went to work when all the men went away, and found themselves middle-aged by the time the men came back. With advanced age comes a reduction in what was, for a mid-century American woman, an already limited number of life choices. It also brings a ticking clock. The actress and character's age is a subject of the movie. Joan Crawford was in her early 40s when Daisy Kenyon was made, and Preminger's camera captures bags under her eyes, even though it's clear that beauty lenses are being used on her close-ups and no one else's. And Dana Andrews' lawyer tells her that he liked her better before, when she was more pliant to him, and obviously, younger. If Mildred Pierce was a movie about a woman chasing in vain after what she believes she and her family deserve, Daisy Kenyon was about a slightly older woman who ultimately grows tired of fighting. In the climactic scene, both men together try to force her to choose between them, but she insists that she wants to be alone. When they won't stop calling her at her country house, she knows they're going to follow her there, and she drives off on the snowy road in a panic. She flips her car over, but survives, basically unhurt physically, but in frozen agony emotionally. Preminger stages an incredible shot of her emerging from the car, cautiously edging into the snowy woods. She looks terrified, like she knows she's been caught. Judgment Day is waiting for her in her cabin in the woods. This is an actress who had played love triangles dozens of times and each time there was an obviously right choice that would make the character happy. In Daisy Kenyon, there are no Prince Charmings. Everyone is flawed, and every relationship is difficult. But as Daisy learns when she crashes in the snow, a woman can't just run away and be alone. Daisy Kenyon was too weird and too complicated for its time, and it wasn't a hit. But Crawford's next two films at Warner Brothers, Flamingo Road and The Damned Don't Cry, did well at the box office. But when her contract with the studio ran out in 1952, Crawford was 48 years old. She was slightly older than contemporaries like Barbara Stanwyck and Betty Davis, and she looked it. For a decade, she had been rocking what is now perceived as the classic Joan Crawford look, with the wide shoulder pads, cheekbones contoured into sculpture, and lips etched into dark red like a stop sign. Once one of the most beautiful and sexual actresses on screen, once she entered her 40s, Crawford was styled for hardness. This definitely matched the hard time her characters had navigating their romantic lives, but eventually it turned into self-parody. Her remaining movies would be all, on some level, about Joan Crawford being old. Joan had a big hit in 1952 with one such film, Sudden Fear, in which she starred as an aged, unmarried heiress-turned-playwright who thinks she's finally found love with an actor, played by Jack Palance. But Joan soon learns that Palance is plotting with his secret girlfriend, played by Gloria Graham, to kill her and take all her money. There's an incredible, and incredibly long, scene in which Joan just reacts while listening to audio proof of the plot against her. It's very difficult to imagine many other actresses in 1952 being able to carry this scene. Barbara Stanwyck, maybe. But with Crawford, there's a subtext that's special, because we know that she used to be so beautiful and so desirable in real life. As we're watching the character come to understand that her life is a lie and that she's in mortal danger, we're also watching the actress confront the delusion that she could be desirable as she used to be, or that she, in 1952, could compete with young blondes like Graham. Joan was very aware that standards were changing around her, and she didn't like it one bit. It was when she was on the award circuit for Sudden Fear that she first saw Marilyn Monroe in the flesh. When asked for her opinion on this up-and-comer, Joan scoffed, "She should be told that the public likes provocative feminine personalities, but it also likes to know that underneath it all, the actresses are ladies." Even worse was the trend of copycat blonde bombshells that Marilyn's success inspired. Of starlets like Jane Mansfield and Mamie Van Doren, Joan was vicious. "Those aren't even actresses," she said. "Those are boobs with mouths trying to get publicity. I got where I did through hard work. It isn't hard work to stick your chest out and make everybody stare at your tits. Please." Joan was nominated for the Best Actress Oscar for Sudden Fear. The ceremony was the first to be televised, another sign of a changing world. And though Joan didn't win, it was a moment of high visibility for her. Soon thereafter, she took a proactive role in the production of her last great film. Johnny Guitar started life as a 1953 novel dedicated to Crawford, written by Joan's friend, the screenwriter Roy Chandler. Joan bought the rights to the novel and set up Johnny Guitar at the low-rent Republic Studios, with the condition that Nicholas Ray be hired to direct. Why was Joan Crawford, the queen of cosmopolitans and working girls, drawn to a Western set in a desert on the verge of transformation by the railroad? maybe because Johnny Guitar, as scripted by Chancellor and the blacklisted Ben Maddow and directed by Ray, used its Western setting as a container for very non-Western themes, like female rivalry, lost love, and the most Craffordian of all, the way an aging woman's necessity to look out for herself can become at odds with conventional femininity. But also, the whole idea started when Crawford started having an affair with her director. The romance probably began towards the end of Ray's marriage to Gloria Graham. It was announced that Ray and Crawford would collaborate on an international thriller called Lisbon. That didn't happen. Paramount shut it down when it looked like Ray was going to spend too much money. And in fact, that movie was eventually directed by actor Ray Milland, starring Maureen O'Hara. And then Crawford, pissed that Paramount wouldn't spend the money necessary to support a star of her stature, brought Ray with her to Republic, where they were so happy to have her that they were willing to throw an unusually high budget at whatever Joan wanted to do. There's some murkiness surrounding the authorship of Johnny Guitar, owing to the involvement of a blacklisted screenwriter. The screenplay was actually credited only to Philip Yordan, who throughout the blacklist era fronted for dozens of blacklisted writers, or depending on who's telling the story, stole credit from them. Whoever wrote Johnny Guitar, Chancellor seems to have been inspired by Joan to write a novel about powerful women at war with one another, and there are lines in the movie that might as well have been written by Joan herself. Witness this exchange between Joan's character, embattled maverick saloon owner Vienna, and Johnny Guitar himself, her ex-boyfriend who has shown up in her Arizona frontier town at her request.
You're the boss.
You haven't changed at all, Johnny.
What made you think I had?
In 5 years, a person should learn something.
5 years ago, I met you in a saloon. Now I find you in one. I don't see much change.
Except I own this one. Come here for a minute. Do you know what this is?
Looks like a lot of towns I've been in.
This town will be here next year. You can own part of it. Share and share alike with Frank, Tom, Eddie, and Sam.
Why me?
Maybe I'll need a gunfighter.
Albuquerque's lousy with gunfighters.
But I sent for Johnny Logan.
I don't use that name anymore.
Oh, so you changed your name and thought that would change everything, huh?
You hired me to do a job.
Is that all you came here for? To do a job?
No. No, I wanted to see you again. Heard you had a little luck.
Luck had nothing to do with it.
I was being polite.
I'm not ashamed of how I got what I have. The important thing is I've got it.
That's the way most people look at it.
Except you. What right have you to judge?
I once loved you. A man takes a pride in something he really cares for. He hates to see it trampled.
A man can lie, steal, and even kill. But as long as he hangs on to his pride, he's still a man. All a woman has to do is slip once, and she's a tramp. Must be a great comfort to you to be a man.
It was more of a comfort to think that you were waiting for me.
Did you honestly believe after 5 years I'd be waiting for you?
Well, I had a long ride up here from Albuquerque. I had to think of something. But it was kind of nice to know that we'd be together again.
Well, that's very generous of you, Mr. Logan. Is that a proposal?
A man's got to stop somewhere. This seems as good a spot as any.
That's just about the most touching speech a woman ever listened to. I'm overwhelmed.
Maybe it's rushing it a little, but that's the general idea, isn't it?
No, Mr. Logan, that isn't my idea at all.
Suppose you tell me.
Oh, it's a sad story.
I listen good to sad stories.
5 years ago, I loved a man. He wasn't good, he wasn't bad, but I loved him. I wanted to marry him. to work with him, to build something for the future.
They should have lived happily ever after.
They didn't. They broke up. He couldn't see himself being tied down to a home.
Looks like the girl did a smart thing in getting rid of him.
She was smart, all right. She learned not to love anybody again.
5 years is a long time. There must have been quite a few men in between.
Enough.
What do you suppose would happen if this man was to come back?
When a fire burns itself out, all you have left is ashes.
Jenny Guitar has been seized on by different groups as emblematic of different things. Auteur-minded critics, following the model set out by French critics-turned-filmmakers like François Truffaut, have declared it to be a work of studio system subversion, using all of the excessive tools of the corporate culture, from the most art direction that money could buy to the movie star herself, to make a personal, idiosyncratic work of art. Johnny Guitar has also become crucial to Joan Crawford's legacy as a gay icon. It's a movie dripping with sexual subtext, with gender subversion as actual text. Crawford literally wears the pants in this film, in image and in action, blurring the line between conventional 1950s masculinity and femininity. All of this later reception invests more depth in the film than anyone in Hollywood did in 1954. The trade critics savaged Johnny Guitar. Crawford and Ray both said that they hated the movie. Ray and various co-stars and crew members blamed Joan for creating a toxic environment on set. Having ended her sexual relationship with the director and believing that she wasn't being treated like the star that she was, Joan reportedly threw tantrums and particularly antagonized co-star Mercedes McCambridge, although that might have been for the good of both performances. Crawford reportedly told Philip Yordan of her frustrations. "I have no part," she is supposed to have complained. "I just stand around with boots on and have a few stupid scenes. I want to play the man. I want to shoot it out in the end with Mercedes McCambridge instead of me playing with myself in a corner." Yordan says that he changed the ending of the film based on this request. Ray was left appalled by his actress's lack of trust in him as a director. By the time the production moved to Hollywood sound stages, Ray claimed that he was so stressed by working with Crawford, who he called one of the worst human beings that he had ever met, that he would have to pull his car over and vomit on his drive to work. It was a long time before Johnny Guitar would ascend to the place in film history where it sits now, where it's probably one of the only Joan Crawford movies that many cinephiles with a European sensibility would embrace as a work of art. Crawford herself never came around to the movie. Shortly before her death, she regretted even having made it. "I should have had my head examined," she said of Johnny Guitar in one of a series of interviews she did during the last decade of her life with journalist Roy Newquist. "No excuse for a picture being this bad, or for me making it." What should be interesting to Nicholas Ray heads is that in the same series of interviews, Crawford reveals herself to be extremely knowledgeable about film history, not just Hollywood film, but European cinema and its relationship to Hollywood. She talks about auteur theory and argues against it, using the then-contemporary films of Robert Altman and Peter Bogdanovich as evidence, quote, "that the whole goddamn industry has forgotten the fact that a film is a team effort, and the public has swallowed this line. I don't think a really honorable director, like George Cukor, would ever say, 'This film is all mine.' But most directors today seem to want to be tin gods." In any case, for all the different lenses through which it's possible to view Johnny Guitar, today it seems undeniable that it's the last truly great film on Joan Crawford's filmography. Joan would disagree. She was particularly proud of Autumn Leaves, a May-December romance between her and Cliff Robertson, as well as the story of Esther Costello. But there's no question, that in the late 1950s, it looked like her career was winding down. Putting aside all of the reasons why Hollywood would have shelved her or found her less useful in her mid-50s than she had been 20 years earlier, Joan herself was, for the first time in her life, happy to work less because she was so happy in her personal life. In 1955, she married Alfred Steele, an executive at Pepsi Cola, and she began traveling with him for his work. She even joined the Pepsi board and started making appearances at corporate events alongside her husband or on his behalf. And then, in 1959, just 4 years after their marriage, the 58-year-old Steele suddenly dropped dead. Joan soon discovered that her businessman husband had been in debt up to her eyeballs, and there was nothing left to keep her in the lifestyle to which she had become accustomed. In fact, Alfred had borrowed money from Pepsi to outfit the lavish Manhattan apartment he and Crawford had lived in together. Pepsi kept Joan on as a spokeswoman, but it wasn't enough. So, Joan Crawford had to do what she had always done. Work. We'll talk about the last phase of her career next week, on the second-to-last episode of 6 Degrees of Joan Crawford. Join us then, won't you? Thanks for listening to You Must Remember This. Today's episode was written, narrated, and produced by Karina Longworth. That's me. Our research and production assistant is Lindsay D. Schoenholtz. Our editor is Sam Dingman. And our logo was designed by Teddy Blanks. If you like the show, please tell anyone you can, any way that you can. You can follow us on Twitter at RememberThisPod and find us on Instagram and Facebook, too. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes if you haven't already and rate and review us there. That really helps people find out about the show. And we have a special announcement. On October 13th, I'll be appearing on a live taping of the Slate Culture Gab Fest in Santa Monica at the Aero Theater. You can buy tickets for this now by going to slate.com/live. This is definitely the only live event of any kind that I'm going to be doing this fall. So if you're in the area, come on out. We'll be back next week with another tale from the secrets and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. Join us then, won't you? Good night.